Hello, and welcome to Tolerable Risk, the podcast for NGO, nonprofit, and charity professionals who manage risk. I'm your host, Sabrina Siegel. Today, we're going to talk to Isabel De Bruyne Cardozo. Isabel is a PhD candidate at the Rotterdam School of Management at the Erasmus University in the Netherlands, where she is researching unethical behavior in NGOs. Her research investigates the NGO halo effect, which proposes that a glorification of NGO moral goodness can lead to unethical behavior being justified, motivated, or ignored by NGOs. Alongside her PhD, Isabel is a senior associate at Principa Advisory, where she consults with a range of organizations on ethical culture, ethical decision-making, and behavior change. She brings with her over 15 years of work experience in the NGO sector, supporting NGOs on ethics management and safeguarding. Isabel, I am thrilled and excited and just so giddy to have you on Tolerable Risk today. The topic that we're going to talk about, this halo effect within third sector organizations, is something that I think is so real in the sector. It's something that I have experienced, and I know colleagues have experienced it. And the fact that you are doing academic study and rigorous research on this topic area is the best. So welcome to Tolerable Risk. I'm so excited to have you on the show.
Thank you so much, Sabrina. I'm really looking forward to discussing this with you and also to hearing from whether you think my research reflects in your own experience with working with nonprofits.
Absolutely. So before we dive into the topic today, for people who aren't familiar with you or the work that you're doing, can you just tell us a little bit about yourself? How did you get into researching the third sector and the topic that you have, and a little bit about your background?
Sure. Well, how I got to my PhD is not necessarily a linear or straight line. After my master's degree, which was in human rights, I started to work on children's rights and child protection specifically, and working with various nonprofits to design child protection policies, to support them in developing child protection programs. And eventually, child protection morphed more into safeguarding. So looking at how nonprofits, but also other types of organizations like UNICEF, other UN agencies, the World Bank, how their operations, how their programming, how their people can do better to keep not just their own staff safe, but also the people who they were reaching. You know, and as a consultant, you're always expected to have the answer. And at some point when I was asked the question, like, how can we do better for the people who we are reaching, I didn't have an answer anymore. That organization had a strong safeguarding policy in place. That organization had their trainings on defining what safeguarding is, how safeguarding can be implemented. Yet there were still incidences of safeguarding abuses happening. So what was not working? And that led me to undertake a PhD. I'm towards the final stage of my PhD, and I'm trying to make sense of how nonprofit organizations, if they are considered to be good, how can that sense of goodness explain why they behave badly?
I think as soon as you said that, so many people who are listening today are going, oh yeah, I know exactly what she's talking about. So let's dive into this then. So tell us a little bit about what your research is. You're talking about safeguarding and you're talking about good organizations maybe that do bad things. And I had mentioned in the beginning this phrase halo effect, but tell us a little bit about exactly what you're researching and what it means.
Sure. The concept of the halo effect came to me a bit later while doing my research. I wanted to first make sense of whether we can indeed talk about a paradox. So in other words, whether we can explain the bad behavior that nonprofits do through this element of goodness. Because unethical behavior in organizations, that has been researched for many years. Interestingly, well, I thought it was interesting, unethical behavior has been explained much more in the business or the corporate sector and much less in the nonprofit sector. That's not to say that various explanations don't exist, but they're quite generic. So they look at, for example, individual characteristics relating to salary, positions of power. They also look at organizational characteristics, like how big the organization is in terms of people, in terms of assets, but also sectoral causes have been looked at. What hadn't been looked at, and that's kind of what sparked my interest in this research, is whether the same characteristics that can explain this goodness of nonprofits can also be the ones that explain their so-called badness. And in so doing, I thought that this perception of moral goodness that can exist within nonprofits can become inflated or can become glorified thereby creating a halo. And in essence, in my research, I'm finding that this halo, so when there is this overestimization or this idealization of goodness, can motivate for unethical behavior. It can help also ignore unethical behavior. It can also help justify unethical behavior. And I specifically look at three elements. So a nonprofit's mission, a nonprofit's morals that are framing the mission, as well as a nonprofit's people. And in my research, I've looked at this both quantitatively, so looking at how people describe their mission, their morals, and the people, but also quantitatively to see how strong this element of the halo is, to be able to understand to what extent do people within nonprofits idealize what they stand for and who they are, and to what extent then can this idealization relate to unethical behavior. And in my latest research, which was the quantitative piece, I was able to find a correlation. So in other words, that the stronger the tendency for people in nonprofits to idealize mission morals people, the stronger the relationship with unethical behavior.
That's really interesting. And it's interesting how you're doing both qualitative and quantitative. Has either one of those been more challenging, the approaches, qualitative or quantitative?
I'm going to approach this from a personal perspective in terms of where I'm more comfortable doing research. Qualitative research is something that I've been doing much more often on, also in my work. So interviewing comes much more naturally than number crunching. That to say, the quantitative research was very interesting because in order to go and measure the extent of the halo, I had to conceptualize in practical terms, what exactly are we talking about, right? How do we measure the existence of a halo? And I used interviews also to be able to come up with this tool. And even though I'm using this tool for my research, it can also be a practical tool that can be used within organizations. And I've been applying that also in my consultancy world. It's for people to be able to see, like, if you were to look at it on a sliding scale with perception of goodness on one end of the scale and glorification of goodness on the other end of the scale, it can help organizations see where they are. And I talk about organizations, but it can also be done at a team level or department level. It's very interesting to also compare this between teams, between departments, to see if a halo is bigger in certain teams or bigger across certain demographics within the organization. And also allows people to understand who sees unethical behavior as unethical. So in terms of the quantitative piece, even though I think the findings are interesting, I think process to get to the findings in terms of developing such a tool was also quite exciting because now we can understand what a halo within nonprofits can look like from a practical perspective.
So you use the word perception in the answer that you just gave me, and a lot of this is people's perception. And one of the things that I've found in my experience working a lot on integrity work is when you're talking about ethics, you're talking about integrity, it can be perception sometimes. We all know where the black and white lines are, but most of where these things happen is in the gray area. So when you were working on your research, or when you're talking about this concept of unethical behavior and the halo effect in organizations, what do people get wrong? What do they misunderstand when you're talking to them and doing your research?
You're absolutely right to say that this is a study in perception. And my research looks at the perception of people working in nonprofits specifically. And when I say people in nonprofits, I'm looking at that from board level to senior management, staff level, including volunteers as well. That said, I don't disaggregate between those groups, but the research really looks at perceptions within nonprofits. But generally speaking, if we were to look at perceptions of others and about what they get wrong, I think there can be a tendency for people to generally fall into two camps. One camp can think of unethical behavior in nonprofits as almost normal in the sense of organizations at the end of the day are comprised of a group of people. People have flaws. It's human nature to have flaws. So by extension, unethical behavior is not a strange phenomenon. Just like unethical behavior in other types of organizations is not a phenomenon. So in other words, that group of people can think this to be a kind of a normal phenomenon. The other group of people can perceive nonprofits to be good or maybe inherently good. If we look at why nonprofits exist, it's because they provide a certain service or provide a certain need that is lacking. That is something that government is not being able to address or even business is able to address. So by addressing a certain forgotten need, there's already kind of that perception of, well, nonprofits are doing something good. But further yet, I think there can be a tendency for one to consider a nonprofit as good when there's an alignment of our own personal values with the mission of a certain nonprofit. And I think this is underscored specifically with social identity theory, right? That we as people get a sense of who we are based on group membership. So we feel good about ourselves when we are working in a nonprofit that implements our values, which makes us feel good about ourselves, but which makes us also perceive the nonprofit as we're working in as good as well. So I just mentioned the perception of two different groups. And what I'm trying to bring together in this research is that these groups do not have to be siloed from each other. Rather, it's that perception of goodness that then can explain unethical behavior. Just following up on your point of perception as well as a perception of others, I think future research would be very interesting to look at how the perceptions of stakeholders outside of nonprofits, which play a key role in the nonprofit sector, how they feed into the halo effect. So I'm thinking about the media. You know, the media scrutinizes nonprofits for their behavior. I'm thinking about donors. Do donors feed into this halo effect, assuming that donors also fund nonprofits based on an aligned set of values? Are they able to see, for example, when certain elements are idealized and that idealization leads to bad behavior? It would also be interesting to look at the perception of the people who the nonprofit reaches. Do they inherently perceive that the services that they're getting from their nonprofits as good? So all this to say, yes, this is very much a study on perception, and there are obviously many stakeholders' perceptions to consider in the story.
Absolutely. I would say even the focus on donors. I did a post on LinkedIn about how this perception of organizations being so squeaky clean and being all good and things like that, when in reality, they may be horrific to work for internally. These organizations win awards. They win big grants from donors. And wouldn't it be interesting if donors said, yeah, okay, send us your proposal, but also send us your most recent staff survey. Let's look at actually how you're treating the people that work for you and what is the satisfaction level of your staff. And maybe if donors looked at some of this criteria, some of these organizations getting these large grants might not get them. I put it out there as an interesting way of thinking about looking at organizations holistically, instead of just saying, well, what's your past performance in a particular area? If donors are serious about safeguarding, right, the area that you started out your career in, shouldn't they be asking questions about how the organization is running itself too? I mean, simple things like, do you have a whistleblower hotline? Is it used? What's your follow-up? Why not ask these questions to make sure that the organization that you're supporting is a good one?
Absolutely. I think that makes a lot of sense. And I also think that it's easy for nonprofits to fall into this trap of being very performance oriented because competition, especially in resource constrained settings, right? And nonprofits need resources in order to function and are dependent on others for getting those resources. So it's very easy for nonprofits then to say, look at this award that we've just been given, or look at the amazing work that we've been doing. And again, particularly in this case, the mission is idealized and thereby prioritized. I think it can be, I use the word easy, but there can be a tendency then for nonprofits to not give as much attention to the safeguarding framework or infrastructure within their organization. So in other words, they're justifying not doing that because of this pressure and this prioritization that they are putting on themselves to meet their mission and to show others how important their mission is. I think this can explain also behavior when nonprofits mismanage their data in terms of how it's reported to either to donors or to the press. In other words, that they're showing that their impact might be better than it actually is. I think the sense of moral justification can also explain why other pieces of information might be withheld. Because again, nonprofits are wanting to show that they need your resources and that they can manage your resources. And to your point about getting those surveys, those satisfaction surveys, those well-being surveys, I think that's a great practical example of how nonprofits can also manage or navigate and maybe also reduce the tendency for this halo effect. In other words, that with these kind of surveys, it can help balance just the prioritization of mission, but to prioritize the internal workings of the organization, coupled with also communicating the work that they're doing to the outside world.
That's great. So based on your research, is it possible that you can give us some examples of the halo effect of how unethical behavior, or just like you're saying, the idolization of the mission has happened in some organizations?
So if we couple back to mission, morals, and people, and if we see that they are then idealized and prioritized, and the question is prioritized over what? So if we're looking at mission specifically and how that is prioritized, we can think that, you know, meeting the mission is prioritized over other things in the organization. So those other things in the organization could be implementing their safeguarding framework. The other things could be about listening to people. I call this a sense of moral justification. In other words, that the means justify the ends, because the ends are considered to be so important and prioritized. Once morals are prioritized, I call this moral superiority, then there can be a tendency in the organization to prioritize their own morals over the morals of outside forces. And that could be legal codes, that could also be general conceptions of what is considered to be good. And that can motivate maybe certain organizations to break a certain law because they don't believe the law to be good. They believe the law to be immoral or unjust, but that they believe their own morals to be rights, morally rights and good. So that can motivate certain types of behavior. I must say here, perception comes into that as well, right? Because then the element of perception of what is unethical comes into play. I think this is really a point of discussion to be held within organizations themselves. Like, what is your definition of unethical behavior? Is breaking the law, for example, unethical? So to give you a practical example, Greenpeace, I'm thinking of 2021, and I hope I'm not getting this date wrong, but in the English Channel marine protected area, meaning that there should be no trawler ships there, but there were, and the government was not doing anything about it. So Greenpeace, with their mission of environmental conservation, tried to address these trawler ships, who are in essence, right, breaking the law. And what Greenpeace did was that they threw massive boulders into the channel. And these boulders also had the names of celebrities as well as others who funded this activity. So in other words, people were very conscious as to where their money was going and very gladly stood behind the mission of Greenpeace doing this. But what happens if a trawler ship catches one of these massive boulders and the risk of capsizing increases and the risk of people's lives being endangered also increases? It was illegal what they did, but would Greenpeace consider this to be unethical practice? Because in essence, what they were doing was addressing their own mission of environmental conservation. And also they were doing this because the government was not doing anything about it. I think this, in this sense, is also that element of our morals needed to be shown. And we stood up for our morals, even though we knew that we were breaking the law. If we look at how third element of how people can be idealized and prioritized, well, then we can consider that inherent trust in people are prioritized over, for example, internal ethics policies or safeguarding policies. So in other words, we're saying that enforceability of internal codes of conduct, safeguarding policies is not implemented because of this thinking that we should give somebody a second chance, a third chance, a fourth chance, because at the end of the day, this person was able to bring in this much money, for example, he should be forgiven. So I call this moral naivete, when there is this sense of people at the end of the day should be forgiven while internal policies are not implemented to the extent that they should be implemented. So those are three examples of how ends can justify the means, how the prioritization of one's own morals can lead to legal norms or other conceptions of good being trumped, as well as this prioritization of people over internal rules. I think those are elements that can explain incidences of unethical behavior.
I think the people one is the one that I can identify with the most. The mission and the morals, I mean, people understand Greenpeace, people understand Sea Shepherd, people understand even Doctors Without Borders sometimes operating in environments that may be questionable. But the people one that you were just talking about, that's the one where I think it can be so toxic. That is what creates these toxic working environments, where you have a high performing bully in the organization, or you have somebody in a position that that leadership believes is just so essential that they can run rampant, sort of really destroying the relationships or culture of the organization. But leadership doesn't really acknowledge that. That is an area that I personally have seen and experienced, and I just think can be so dangerous. So your examples are really, really spot on. So aside from toxic work environments and bullying and things like that, can you talk a little bit about the risks that you see to organizations based on your studies? How can that cause a threat to organizations?
Yeah, and you make a good point also by just focusing on the people, because I'm also looking at ethical behavior from two different sides. So on ethical behavior on behalf of the organization, so that stands to benefit, in essence, the organization, but also on ethical behavior against the organization. So looking at harassment, looking at fraud, but the organization does not stand to benefit from that. So there are different elements of risk, right? We're looking at what can be the risks that can activate unethical behavior against the organization. So your harassment, your fraud, for example. But it could also be interesting to look at risk for unethical behavior on behalf of the organization. And I think with the latter, risk on behalf of the organization, this could be like trumping legal norms, for example. So the Greenpeace example. I think that requires a lot of clarity and discussion within organizations about what the organization actually stands for. So I've worked with organizations, for example, that have some of these guiding principles that they all believe to be clear. But for example, respect. And I ask people within the organization, what does respect mean for you? And respect was one of their guiding principles. I get 7 different answers from 7 different people. So this comes to show that there is no clarity about your guiding principles. And with respect to risk, how can we mitigate that risk? I think it's about having these discussions about, are we clear on what we stand for? Are we clear about what our guiding principles mean in practice? And especially when we talk about our moral compass and our North Star, do we know what we're standing for? And if that answer is yes, we know, then arguably that element of risk can be mitigated in terms of the organization acting unethically. Because then in their point of view, they won't be considered to be unethical because they are enacting principles which they consider to be a reflection of their own perception, again, moral goodness. With respect to risk on mitigating interpersonal bad behavior within an organization, like harassment or financial misconduct, so behavior that ultimately hurts your organization, arguably that goes back to strengthening recruitment processes. Through my interviews, I find that even if there are terms of reference, job descriptions, it's still very much a word of mouth based culture. And that can also then come back to this element of pressure to meet the mission, right? Because recruitment takes time. But if you have word of mouth from someone who has worked in a so-called reputable nonprofit, you're more likely to think, oh no, but they have worked in that reputable organization, they must be good. You might not do your due diligence as well. You might not go so far as to follow up with references. You might not go so far as to ask certain questions during your interview. You might not go so far to ensure that there is a proper induction or training, particularly on your organization's principles. In addition to recruitment, but having those continued training, but also discussions, again, on the principles of what the organization stands for. Having joint reflection processes, these are some of the ethical dilemmas that we are facing. How would you approach this? For example, a fundraising team or a marketing team might not consider some practices unethical because they think at the end of the day that they are required to bring in as much money or as many resources as possible, again, in order to be put into the mission. So they might not consider some behavior as unethical, while other team members might. So for example, time is money, you know, work harder. This can lead to more bullying, right? You're not working hard enough. I'm calling you away from your family on the weekend to come in and work more because a mission is so important. Time is money. I think being aware, again, of the different perceptions within the organization as to the clarity, as well as that level of discussability on unethical behavior can be another way to mitigate that risk of unethical behaviors happening.
I think your point about recruitment is so interesting because it's not an angle that I would have thought about. But when you describe it, it makes a lot of sense. Do you really know who you're bringing into the organization and what they're bringing with them? And so I think that's a really good point. I would also, though, and I have to say, When I was younger, when I was more idealistic, I would have said, yes, organizational culture is an all staff thing. Everybody has to play their part and it's really important. But as I get older and maybe more bitter and more jaded and more experienced, I'm very squarely of the school of thought that leadership is really responsible for organizational culture. And if leadership is not really aware of and understanding how they are strengthening a positive culture or contributing to a negative culture, then you're kind of done for. I've worked in organizations where you've had high-performing bullies that have just left a wake of destruction, no matter where they're going, and people making excuses, saying, oh, well, you know, yeah, that's just the way that person is. They don't mean any harm. It's just the way they are. And you go, but that's not the right way to act, right? And it's like, oh, but these excuses are being made because they're very good at their job, right? Or raising the issue about, well, look, our organization doesn't have a whistleblower reporting hotline. Our organization doesn't have a way for people to report concerns that they have, or even our participants in our programs to report concerns that they have. And the response from leadership being, ah, well, you know, if we do that, it'll call too much attention to our compliance. I mean, how do you even respond to that? So I guess from my point of view, I would say it really comes down to leadership. And if you have bad leadership, or if you have leadership that is not acknowledging that these are problems, the organization will never change. Does that sync up with your research? Am I on to something, or does the data that you're collecting tell a different story?
Well, absolutely. I think leadership plays a crucial role in role modeling, right? And then the question is, but what is positive role modeling? Like, in absence of unethical behavior, how would that look like in practice? And I think, again, that goes back to leadership discussing dilemmas or putting forward dilemmas. Like, if we were to make a decision on this or that, how would the organization go about addressing this dilemma? We look often at unethical behavior as black and white, easy rights or wrongs, but we know that unethical behavior, like the majority, falls in that gray zone. And then it's really up to the organization, and specifically led by leadership, to be able to define, to decrease that gray zone, and to be able to clarify, this is exactly what we stand for. And not just defining what they stand for, but also enforcing that. So if there is kind of slippage into the darker side, then there will be repercussions for that. So in other words, the policies will be implemented that define unethical behavior, right? So your code of conduct or your safeguarding policy. I think the implication then also is having a strong human resource department. And if it's not a question about having a strong human resource department, but having that ombudsman, and this is also to your point about whistleblowing, having those strong structures in place that can pick up on complaints and do something about that, and enforcing what the organization says that they would do, and also being transparent about it. And I don't mean transparency in the sense of sharing any identifiable information, but being transparent of how cases are managed, to also signal to the organization that unethical behavior is being taken seriously.
I think your emphasis on having these independent roles that are equally as authoritative, I want to say, but a lot of times this is a power dynamic issue, right? And so you can have an HR division with a lot of very talented HR people, but if they are subservient to the chief operating officer and the CEO doesn't want to listen to them, right, what good are they going to be able to do? So a good structured ombudsperson tends to be independent and have that ability to speak truth to power. So I like your focus on that. Let me ask you this. If somebody is listening today and they go, wow, okay, it sounds like what Isabel's talking about is describing my organization. What can an organization do if they realize that they're slipping down this slope? Is it possible to turn these organizations around? How do you do it? How do you raise that flag and say, we need to acknowledge this? Because again, if it's coming from leadership, how can that even be addressed?
So also, in addition to the point about having independent avenues, it's also about having a board which is present and a board that can pick up on these issues. I think a board should be able to have a very strong sense of the ethical culture of the organization that they are either advising or directing. And I understand this is dependent on the jurisdictions, but in some cases, a board does have the capacity to hire and fire the CEO. And a board, while by no means micromanaging the day-to-day work of nonprofits, should be able to have a relationship with the organization that goes beyond just the CEO or executive director. And so human resources could should be able to address the board, especially when cases relate to CEOs. That channel should be open. And I've seen that in some boards, there is a designated safeguarding person in some boards to be able to address these cases. In some boards, safeguarding is also a regular topic of conversation. So I think boards also play a strong role in keeping a finger on the pulse of the ethical culture that is happening, and for boards also to be able to participate in ethical decision-making processes. So going back to these dilemmas, these are hard discussions to have. Involve the board. You know, the more discussability, and I know that's not a real word, but the more that these dilemmas are discussed, the more clarity that is gained through these discussions, which hopefully then allows organizations to have a better understanding of what they stand for and what they should do in order to do what they stand for, practice what they preach. So the role of the board, I think, is very fundamental in this regard.
I think your emphasis on the board is really spot on, because that group of people is really the only equal power source to a leadership team that may be in and of itself toxic or just turning a blind eye to the toxic environment that it's creating.
Order!
So Isabel, if you were advising boards or trustees on this topic, with the understanding that in a lot of small to medium-sized, low to no resource organizations, board members or trustees are volunteers. They probably don't have experience being on boards before. Their heart is in the right place. They believe in the mission of the organization. They don't want to harm the organization. Maybe they don't want to embarrass themselves in these board meetings. How would you advise them to do some investigation around this topic? Get a sense if the organization is suffering from this sort of halo effect or suffering from putting mission, morals, people not in the right way at the center of the organization. What kind of questions can they ask? Investigation can they do? Who can they invite to their meetings to talk to make sure that they're actually getting the truth and not maybe a message that the senior leadership team wants them to hear?
I think the first discussion is to check your values, because even though nonprofits can have their guiding charter, if you will, or their strategic plan, sometimes it's easy to lose track of values. And especially if we consider values, again, to be this moral compass, rechecking values and ensuring that there is clarity on all fronts of values. Maybe that's just like a sense-checking exercise. Often, these discussions are held every so often, maybe at the start of a strategic planning process or not. But to have, again, that strong organizational understanding of, are the values clear and are they often discussed? In terms of culture, well, I mentioned that tool that I developed for the Halo. It's a user-friendly tool that can help, again, sense check to what extent mission, morals, and people can be idealized and prioritized. And by this, I want to also say directly, like, this perception of moral goodness is in itself not a bad thing. If anything, it's very normal, right? I mean, we work for organizations and we work with people that we generally perceive of as good. That's a motivating force. It's what Ali brings us also joy and satisfaction to our work. That is not the problem. The problem is when that perception of goodness can become glorified. And to give like specific words that have come up in the interviews, right? So when people glorify their colleagues, they are referred to as family members, even though they are not family members. They are referred to as heroes, as saints, as angels. I think you're getting the message, right? So in other words, they are seen as better than they are. So when you're referring to this leader, very toxic, but able to do a lot of between words good for the organization, he's almost being sanctified because of the goodness that he's doing. In terms of mission, some people have identified with their organization's mission as a life calling, as compared to a marriage commitment, as to the embodiment of their moral being. So in other words, it goes much more beyond, between quotes, just a job, much more than a 9-to-5. So I get this tendency of glorification can motivate or can enable certain mechanisms that can just slip into unethical behavior. And being aware kind of that sliding scale between goodness and glorification can help organizations sense check. So I'm happy to, for whoever's interested, send that tool around. But there are also other surveys where organizations can get an understanding of their ethical culture. So I work for a consulting firm called Principia Advisory, and we have several tools that are based on evidence, in other words, that have been validated, that can measure kind of the strengths and weaknesses of an organization's culture. And linked to that also reflects on decision making. Who makes decisions and how transparent are those decisions and what are the implications of those decisions on ethical culture? These tools can be self-implemented. In other words, you don't need an outsider to help conduct them, even though I do think from personal experience that if you have an outsider's lens, if you will, they can maybe pick up on certain elements that the organization cannot. So in other words, it can help be a mirror, an outsider, to interpret those findings and help be a mirror on where the organization is standing.
I think it's great that you used the word sanctification, because it's not a common word that's used. But a lot of times when we're talking about this toxic environment or hostile working environments, things like that, and we're talking about the free flow of information, I've heard this word sanctification used before. Actually, I have another guest that was on a previous podcast who was talking about boards being able to get real information. And he used the word sanctification. He's saying, you know, a unit or a team might generate a report and it might have some real challenges in it, some real problems. And by the time it gets through middle management, up to senior leadership, and then to the board, the information has been, and he used the word sanctified. And so it's really interesting that you used that word too, talking about this lack of transparency or this perception that the mission of the organization or the people in the organization can do no wrong. We're not really seeing the real environment that we're working in. So it's interesting. And I also think too, that your point about having an outsider view some of these things, I would actually say that's really crucial for a couple of reasons. Sure, organizations can use these tools, but if you're asking people to provide feedback, honest feedback, but they know that the leadership is going to be the ones looking at it, the likelihood that they're going to actually say what's on their mind is pretty low. If they believe that it's an outsider, if they believe that there is some trust and they can speak freely, the organization is probably a lot more likely to get the real information. And so having that third-party neutral person facilitate these conversations and gather that data is important. But again, who is that third party going to be handing this information off to? A senior leadership team who doesn't particularly care? A board who may or may not be engaged? What is the likelihood that an organization can really turn itself around if it's in this situation? What do you think, Isabel?
That's also where accountability comes in and holding leadership to accounts. If an organization does commit to having, for example, a zero tolerance culture, that has implications as to how particularly senior leadership manages that value. And it also goes down, again, back to the role of boards, having a board that is present, having a board that listens, having a board that is also close enough, but just far enough removed as well to be able to observe. Working towards an ethical culture is a commitment, an organizational-wide commitment. And yes, leadership plays a role, but it is not the only role. An ethical culture starts with all of us within organizations, and it's calling out good behavior, it's calling out bad behavior. It's that willingness to also engage in discussion. I think also that willingness to be vulnerable. And I think that is something very difficult for the nonprofits as a sector, because vulnerability can be seen as a weakness. And particularly when we're talking again about competing for resources in resource-constrained settings, we don't want to show our weak side. We want to show like all the amazing work that we've been doing to reach the people that we are meant to be reaching. So we are sanctifying what we're doing to outsiders, thinking that would give us more recognition, to give us more money in order to implement our mission. But to the extent that organizations actually come out and say, we've made a mistake and this is how we're addressing it, we've seen it and we're taking action, we're holding ourselves accountable, that is something very brave to do. And I have seen increasingly over the years that some nonprofits have done that, and that's actually being positively recognized by donors, because we know that even with a safeguarding policy or a code of ethics, things can still happen. Bad things can still happen. Then is that a question that a safeguarding policy is not working? No, then it's a question that how is the organization dealing with these incidents? It's about how the organization responds that I think will make or break also that ethical culture.
I think your point about accountability is 100% spot on. It's a question of, just like you said, we know these things are going to happen. Organizations are composed of humans and people make mistakes, or maybe even people are doing things that are bad on purpose, right? We know those people are among us, but it's how does the organization respond and how do they stand up and say we are accountable? I think that maybe if donors asked less about what was the number of reports that you had on your hotline and more asking from a point of curiosity instead of judgment, how do you respond to these things? Right? Have disciplinary actions been taken? Have tough conversations happened? When there are allegations against senior leadership, how is that addressed? How seriously is that taken? That might be a really great way to hold some of these organizations more accountable, particularly if it was donors or in some countries, regulators that were asking those questions.
Exactly. Exactly. I think it's more about, exactly to your point, Sabrina, how are you addressing rather than what is happening? Because the what is happening question is almost like a moral judgment, but how are you addressing it shows also understanding that things can go wrong. I've also seen donors facilitate such conversations amongst the nonprofits that they fund, for nonprofits to come together in a safe space without the donor there, for them to kind of share their lessons about what they have done in order to, for example, strengthen accountability measures or what transparency means, or even just having that conversation about what does accountability mean and what is the role of senior leadership in accountability, but also the role of leadership in being held accountable. But I think this is also one of these kind of promising practices or these learnings that we can benefit from that, again, to the point of discussability, and the more that is shared as to how we can do better, the more creative and innovative can approach these conversations, but also developing structures which are not too heavy bureaucratic-wise, but which are accessible to various stakeholders and which, simply put, work.
I think that focus on accountability is absolutely essential. We could talk about accountability for a whole nother episode, but let's move on. Everything we've talked about today is dynamic. It's changing, a lot like risk. Things are rarely ever static. So for people who want to learn more, continue their education on the things that we've talked about today, maybe read some of the things that you have been writing. What are some suggestions for continuing education? Ideally, hopefully low or no cost, because small and medium-sized organizations don't have a lot of resources. But if people want to read more, learn more, listen to a podcast, take an online class, what are some places they can go to get more information?
Well, of course, in addition to your own podcast, I also really like a podcast by Tosca von Pfeiffer-Aikert. She has a podcast called NGO Soul and Strategy, and she also engages with both practitioners as well as academics on very similar issues that you are talking about. While not explicitly relating to risk, she is talking about power, she is talking about safeguarding, she is talking about the other dynamics that can create ethical culture, but also like the enablers that can strengthen an ethical environment within NGOs. And her podcast is specifically also focused on our sector. In terms of my publications, I would, of course, love to share them with you. They're all open access and I can share the link. Tosca has also written a book specifically on NGOs and trying to make sense of unethical behavior. This is what specifically comes to mind at the moment.
That's great. All right, Isabel, I'll get the details and we'll put them in the show notes so that people can find links to the podcast, the book, and your papers that you've written so that people can read more. So before we close today, is there anything that we didn't cover? Any parting words of wisdom that you want to share with folks who are listening about the topic?
I hope that this conversation with you, Sabrina, allows people to understand the danger of slipping into this over-SMization of goodness. And again, perceiving one's organization, people as good, is not the problem. If anything, that is, again, that motivating force. But hopefully listeners are able to see this risk of idealizing missions, morals, and people, and how that can be a risk for unethical behavior. So hopefully listeners will walk away with the message that we should not see goodness as paradoxical to badness, but rather that goodness, again, once glorified, can actually breed unethical behavior. If anybody wants to follow up with me, then they can reach out to my email, which is debrine@rsm.nl. Also put that in the show notes. And if there are any other reactions, I'd be also happy to engage with listeners on LinkedIn.
That's great. So people can reach out to Isabel. We'll put her email address in the show notes. And of course, as she said, you can find her on LinkedIn. So thank you so much for your time today, Isabel. This has been fascinating. Your research is fascinating. It really hits close to home for me, and I'm sure for a lot of other folks who have been listening to the episode today. So thanks for your time.
Thank you for inviting me, Sabrina. I enjoyed the conversation with you.
So that's our show for today. Please remember to like, subscribe, and follow us for all your third sector risk information. Thanks for listening to Tolerable Risk.